WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. If you're a blues fan, then you'll recognize this classic. We're listening to Feel Like Going Home from the iconic Muddy Waters. You can't talk about Chicago blues without discussing Muddy Waters. His talent shaped the genre and fostered a community of legends like John Lee Hooker, B.B. King, and Chuck Berry. Now, recently, as part of our What's That Building series, we've looked at music hotspots in the city, the Salt Shed and the Pritzker Pavilion. And today, we're looking at something a little different. Our architecture sleuth Dennis Rodkin takes us to Mojo Museum, aka the 19th century two-flat in Kenwood that was Muddy Waters' longtime home and rehearsal space. The sweet sounds of blues still ring throughout the area today during monthly backyard concerts, and we'll hear from the family member keeping the blues great's memory alive. Now here's Dennis.
We've been to the big monumental places, the Pritzker Pavilion, the Salt Shed, very sophisticated places. So I thought we should look at a complement to that, Muddy Waters' house, which is a place where he played music. He and other musicians played in the front yard you and I are standing in.
Wow.
And now this summer there are concerts. The museum has purchased the lot next door, the empty lot next door, and once a month there are blues concerts in his memory.
Well, before we get to the details of those concerts in this museum, I want to go back, Dennis, because I think we need to get some history on Muddy Waters, and I hear it begins in Mississippi.
It does, but we don't know when. He was born sometime between 1913 and 1915. His name was McKinley Morganfield. Various changes in the family, he ends up being raised by his grandmother. He likes fishing in a muddy stream, so his grandmother calls him Muddy.
Ah.
Eventually, he has 3 years of schooling. At 8 years old, he goes to work as a cotton sharecropper. But he's messing around with music, and he's in his 20s when a couple of music scholars who are working their way around rural parts of the South, recording folk musicians, blues musicians, and they play for this young man who's going by the name Muddy Water, the first recording he's heard of his music, and he says, you know, I could probably make a go of this.
Mm.
They label the record, accidentally, Muddy Waters, and that becomes his name. So McKinley Morganfield becomes Muddy Waters. That's 1941, and in 1943, he leaves for Chicago.
So he leaves Mississippi for Chicago.
Leaves Mississippi, joining the Great Migration.
So does he start playing music immediately, especially now that he knows he's super talented?
This is the great part of why we are standing here today, Sasha. He's playing at house parties. He's not yet established a career. He's working at a paper factory. He's got other manual labor jobs, and he's playing at house parties.
Amazing.
Until he starts to gather an audience, and he, in 1947, 4 years after he gets to Chicago, he's playing for Chess Records, which is really sort of the launching pad for so many music
legendary
careers from Chicago.
And so he's got several hit songs by that point, right?
He does. Some of the early ones, well, the first one is Long Distance Call, Rolling Stone,
which
is the one that the band eventually takes the name. He does I Feel Like Going Home. He's got a couple of hits, and he's got a contract with Chess Records. So 1954, 11 years out of sharecropping, he goes to buy this house in North Kenwood.
Makes perfect sense. Now he can afford it.
And here's the problem. He's black. Black people had a very hard time, of course, buying a house in Chicago at that time because of redlining. Mortgages were not available to most black home buyers. There was a predatory scheme that sort of set in to replace that called contract buying, where really all the advantage was in the hands of the seller
And the buyer, in this case McKinley Morganfield and his wife Geneva, really are at the whim of the seller. They can run up fees for anything you do. They can just wipe out whatever home equity you have come up with.
Wow.
So here's this guy. He's on his way. He's not yet, but he's on his way to becoming a worldwide musical influence. But like so many other black home buyers in Chicago, he's constrained by these racist rules that make it necessary to pay on a contract.
So what was the price of the house?
They paid $18,000 in 1954. That's the equivalent of paying $210,000 today.
Oh, okay. So this house, it's so hard to believe that we're standing in front of the same place that you're talking about right now. First of all, I mean, it looks amazing for something that's been around for so long.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things about these 1890s two flats in Chicago, you know, built to last forever, to last through an awful lot of things. This was a two-unit building, but it actually was divided into three. Muddy and his wife and family lived here on the first floor behind this arched window we can see.
Yeah.
Second floor was divided into two units. And he often gave housing to musicians who came up from the South who were recording with him or weren't. Chuck Berry stayed here, Howlin' Wolf, John Lee Hooker, B.B. King.
So they're living here. It's also a rehearsal space at the same time.
His rehearsal space is in the basement. They're rehearsing in the basement. Willie Dixon is coming by all the time. He's the writer of a lot of the songs. And many times they performed just because right out here in the front yard. And you can picture the neighbors all coming to watch. Exactly as will happen when there's a concert here the second Saturday of every month in the summer.
That's incredible. Now, at some point, Muddy Waters moves out of this house. Is that right?
It is. And, you know, it's really interesting. He moved out of Chicago for the reason an awful lot of people did, particularly black people did. His wife, Geneva, dies in 1973, and he moves with three of his kids to Westmont in the western suburbs, in large part because of the quality of the schools.
Okay.
Much better there than here on the south side of Chicago.
So funny how much things have not changed.
Right. And how much, though he's this breakout musician, he's also just like everybody else.
A dad. Just yeah. Wanting some good education for his kids.
For his three kids, yeah. So Wow. They moved to Westmont, but he holds on to the house. And then he died in 1983, 10 years after moving to the suburbs. But the house is still in the family's hands today. So he bought it 1954. He and Geneva bought it 1954. And today, 70 years later, it's still in the family's hands.
Okay, well then how did it stay in the family?
He's renting it to musicians after he leaves.
Okay.
And then in 2000, his granddaughter and great-granddaughter, Amelia and Chandra Cooper, buy it from his estate. Amelia eventually signs it over to Chandra, and Chandra, the great-granddaughter, has owned the house now for about 20 years, and she's the one leading the effort to turn it into the Muddy Waters Mojo Museum.
So before we get there, I mean, the city came close to ordering demolition twice on this property.
Right. Once in the 90s, in the mid-90s, when Chandra and Amelia don't yet own it, when Muddy has died, his estate owns it, and it's falling apart. And then in 2013, there's another close call with demolition. The house has fallen into foreclosure. The city may demolish it. There's a lot of work around trying to save it. And ultimately, it was saved. And Chandra ends up paying off the mortgage and getting started on this plan to turn it into a museum, which the family had talked about for at least 15 years prior.
Right. Okay, so let's talk more about this effort by Chandra. So the property is now owned by a nonprofit that she runs, right? And the property is now a city landmark.
Just a couple of years ago, got city landmarking. That does a couple of things. It makes you more eligible for grants, not only from the city, but from other groups. In the past couple of years, she has gotten about $1.5 million in grants. One was from the Mellon Foundation. The biggest, $1.1 million, was from the Mellon Foundation. Because the house needs a lot of work.
I mean, yeah.
Look, it actually looks better now while we're standing in front
of
it.
Yeah, this looks pretty good to me.
Yeah, a couple
but
of years ago.
But you saw it before in a different phase.
All boarded up. Second floor completely boarded up, and I think the first floor was as well. You can see there's a metal security door on the front.
Yeah.
One of the things she has had to do is replace the roof because it was falling apart, so there was leakage inside. And you can see the second story bay is being repaired. She hasn't yet let people inside, but there's apparently a lot of work to be done inside.
Oh, so you mean we're not going to get a look in the building?
I have been asking for so long, and we're still not getting in.
Darn it, Dennis. Listen, the only reason I invited you here was I thought you had the hookup.
I thought I invited you.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason I did is because this is such a great spot
for those Saturday afternoon concerts.
Yes, you mentioned that they've been doing these blues concerts for the summertime.
Yeah, it's great. So they acquired the empty lot next door from the city this year. And what happens is they set up a tent sort of halfway down the lot, and blues musicians play. A lot of the audience is out here by the sidewalk because it's where the shade is, and it's hot summer Saturday.
It's where we're standing right now, to be honest.
But when I was here for the one in June, it was amazing. The music was great. And the crowd is really interesting. It's the neighbors. It's people who've blues fans from the north side who've ridden all the way here by bike.
Wow.
It's a pretty interesting crowd because I think almost everybody has a connection to the house, to Muddy Waters, to the blues, to the history. It's really interesting.
So you went to the one that was in June?
In June.
And, I mean, how did it feel?
It was great. It was a woman named Melody Angel who, I mean, she really rocked. It's kind of cool to be out here in the yard and have her just pounding away.
Oh, she's incredible. We've had her on Reset before.
Yeah, she's a powerful performer. And, of course, there were other musicians. Her mom was here selling her CDs.
Of course.
I said, people are gathered in the shade drinking Gatorade or whatever else they've brought for the day. And you can kind of feel, I of course never met Muddy Waters, but you can kind of feel that spirit
that
of
energy.
A house party, a house concert with some big time musicians.
And so, of course, we just walked in on some preparation for the July concert. Folks were mowing the lawn and getting the trim ready. And I can already feel the excitement.
You know, I think it's a great scene. I'm going to miss the July one, but in August I'll be here. And I'm really looking forward to it. People park across the street. Everybody wants to talk.
Yeah.
You know, so we've been to the Salt Shed. We've been to the Pritzker Pavilion. I don't mean any disservice to them. But those are more like, you know, the church of music. This is the front yard, the front porch of
There's
music.
An intimacy about this spot that
there
I
is.
Really enjoy.
There is.
Yeah.
And one of the phrases they use, I don't think they've trademarked it, is they call this the original House of Blues.
Ooh, I like that.
You say you love me, darling. Please call me on the phone sometime. Say you love me, darling.
So joining us now is Chandra Cooper, great-granddaughter of Muddy Waters, and the president, executive director, and founder of Muddy Waters Mojo Museum. Welcome back to Reset, Chandra.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So I'm curious, you lived in the house as a child, right?
I did. So I was born in 1970. Not to date myself, but born in 1970.
Okay.
And so I was able to live there for 3 years, the first 3 years of my life. And so when I came home from Illinois Masonic Hospital, that's where I came home to.
Oh, wow. Now, talk about your great-grandfather. I mean, what's your favorite memory of him?
Oh, you know, he was just always a very loving and very kind man. And my most precious memory was every time he would come back from being overseas off the, you know, on the road, he would have his guitar luggage with him.
Mm-hmm.
And on that guitar luggage, he had like all of these like stickers. And there were stickers from like all of the different places that he's gone to throughout the world. And so I would look at those stickers. I'm like, oh, you're in Australia and you're in Ireland. And I was like, one day I want to travel with you. And so I'm an avid traveler now because of that guitar suitcase and just knowing that he went around the world singing his music.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Now, just to clarify, I mean, did your great grandfather ever live in the house at the same time as you?
Absolutely. He stayed in the house from the early 1950s up until 1973. And so I was actually in the house with him.
Wow.
My mother is his granddaughter. And so he raised her because her mother died at a young age. And so my mom had me as a teenager. And so I consequently was able to be raised by my great grandfather as well. Him and his wife, they really were very fond of me, I was told. On her deathbed, because she died right after 1973, she asked him to, you know, always take care of her and make sure she was, I was fine. And so I kind of look at this whole house situation of me being in preservation now and me making sure his legacy lives on forever through this house is like my way of giving back to my ancestors for all the good they did for me in my life when I was so young.
Yeah, tell us more about that, Chandra. You know, you're turning this house into a museum, which is a pretty big deal. So I want to hear more about the choice to do that and not keep it residential. Why does it matter so much?
Yeah, you know, for 20 years, I've been pitching this idea and concept to people like, this could be a house museum. It would be great. Not only would we tell the story of Muddy Waters, but tell the story about Chicago Blues, tell the story about, you know, how they met the Rolling Stones and all of that. I mean, because it's so significant in American history, but also blues history, right? And so for 20 years, I've been telling people like, hey, we should do a house museum. So finally, it came to fruition, started in 2019. So from my perspective, I always looked at that house being so significant. You know, it's one thing that you can have a residential house. I could have lived there. I could have family members live there. But I always felt like this was a way for me to give back to my family, to ensure the legacy lives on. And, you know, when we talk about Muddy Waters, we talk about him being the king of Chicago blues, the godfather of, you know, of blues. And so I wanted to really honor that space because that space is so significant.
Yeah.
You know, I always tell people if these walls could talk, that house could talk. Yeah. Why is that house so significant? So the house is so significant is because not only did he live on the first floor, but the basement is where they rehearsed. The basement is where they practiced. The basement is where the band members actually stayed. And so all of that is history. And so why not preserve it in what it is? And so today that house sits as a Chicago landmark.
You know, the house has been in the family for 70 years, right? And that alone, I think, is rare, Chandra. And on top of that, your great-grandparents, though they had money and they had some fame at the time, they had to buy the house on contract like other Black home buyers. So yeah. When you think about past to present, how mm-hmm. significant is that aspect of the home's history to you?
I think it's very significant. I think people don't realize that he bought this house in 1953. Black people were not buying homes in 1953. He actually worked out a deal with the owners. I believe they were Polish. And so he lived there. What I was told was he lived there for a short amount of time as a renter. And then he worked out a deal where they actually allowed him to buy the house. But home buying was not a thing in the 1950s for African Americans. At the time as well, that area was not an African American area. It was very mixed at the time. You know, it's in a very nice area on 43rd and Lake Park. It's a prominent area now. Back in the day, it was even different. So the fact that, you know, this sharecropper, my great-grandfather, had the wherewithal and he was smart enough to realize the value of owning a property in a significant area is, again, another piece of history. And so that's one of the reasons why I really fought to keep the house.
Yeah.
Me keeping the house was a struggle. So let me just tell you about the struggle. So I'm a part of my grandfather's estate. At one point, it was brought to the estate members' attention that, hey, we should get rid of this house because we don't need it. It's old. It's raggedy. You know, I was the only one who was like, no, this should not be sold. This should stay in the family. And I need first rights to, you know, refuse this. And I'm saying that I want the place. And so that's how I got possession of the house. So it's very significant. I knew early on. And again, I always say that my ancestors were always looking after me and just giving me wisdom and giving me input in my life as mm-hmm. I walk, but also in this project. But really, you know, it was very significant. I don't think initially people really, you know, took this idea and this concept serious. But as you can see now where we are, it's a project that is worthwhile. It's a legacy project as
for
well.
For sure. And it's alive and kicking. We're fresh off the July concert. So I wonder how it makes you feel now to see the house and the yard rocking with live blues music again.
It's everything that I've dreamed about. We're not there yet because we'll be there like when we open the doors. But it's everything that I've dreamed about. I dreamed about this house being a museum, this house being a place that the community can go to, this place being a place where international visitors of Chicago would come and say, oh, This is Muddy Waters' House of the Blues, a place of inspiration, a place of wellness as well, right? And so we call the garden area, the vacant lot, we call it a healing garden, just because understanding the properties of wellness and healing and the things that, you know, to be honest, what my grandfather had to go through as a sharecropper and him coming to Illinois through the Great Migration. And so I'm just so excited about the future of the Muddy Waters Mojo Museum.
So you talked a lot about the journey that it's been, right, to get this to a museum, but it's far from finished, as you alluded to. So tell us about what's still left to do.
Yeah, so we have the significant funding that is needed for the rehab purposes of the house. So the entire rehab of the house is completely funded. But our next journey, when we get done with that, and we hope to be done with that by the end in 2025, we hope to be done with the rehab. But then we start working on the inside. So we have started doing some work in the inside. So what does that work look like? It looks like us making sure that we have our exhibit designs in place and that kind of thing. And so going through that journey is fun as well. And so we're just excited about the entire process. It's a labor of love, but we're getting it done. And so soon we'll have our doors open for the community and the international blues community as well.
So leave us with this, Chandra. The most important part of your great-grandfather Muddy Waters' legacy, in your view?
Wow. I would say the most important part of his legacy is letting people know that Muddy Waters is definitely the American dream. Why do I say that? He's the American dream because this man, again, was a sharecropper that moved to Chicago, Illinois, and became an international blues singer. If he can do it, anyone can do it. And so we want to be able to share that Americana story with everyone.
That's Chandra Cooper, great-granddaughter of Muddy Waters and president, executive director, and founder of the Muddy Waters Mojo Museum. Thank you so much for making the time for us, Chandra.
Thank you.
That episode of The Reset Pod was produced by me and Ethan Schwab, who also mixed the episode. It was edited by Meha Ahmed. Now, if you love learning the stories about Chicago's buildings and peeking into how history is being preserved, hit subscribe. We bring you these conversations every other Monday. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you this afternoon.
Got my mojo working, but it just won't work on you. Got my mojo working, but it just won't work on you. I wanna love you so bad, I don't know what to do.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.